Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, we are on the air. I'm going to be talking to Glenn Greenberg again. He's coming back. And we're going to be discussing his other work on Spider-Man, helping write Goblins at the Gate with Roger Stern, writing a Dracula miniseries at Marvel, working on the Star Trek Untold Voyages comic, and his tenure writing Rampaging Hulk. Okay, and Glenn is in here now. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, Victor. How are you?
I'm real good. When we left off last week, we had just finished discussing when you were editing the Hobgoblin Lives, which had Roger Stern reveal the original Hobgoblin's identity.
Yes.
Okay, so that led into, about a year later, I believe, Goblins at the Gate. That was the Spectacular Spider-Man story arc that you and Roger Stern co-wrote.
Right.
Okay, what parts did you do on it? Were you just doing the actual scripts or what?
Well, that was an interesting process. What had happened was, after Hobgoblin Lives, Roger and I were kicking around ideas, and Roger had this idea that he wanted to do as a follow-up that he was hoping he would be able to do with Ron Frenz, the artist on Hobgoblin Lives. And the idea was he wanted to put the original Hobgoblin, Roderick Kingsley, up against the original Green Goblin, Norman Osborn, because for all the time that Roger was doing his Hobgoblin stories in The Amazing Spider-Man, Norman was considered to be dead. So the Hobgoblin original versus the Green Goblin original could never have happened during that period of time. So he wanted to do it as a follow-up. And for whatever reason, it never got done. I'm not 100% sure why. Maybe Roger just, didn't put together a formal pitch there just wasn't enough interest from Marvel. Whatever the reason, I don't remember. So fast forward about a year or two later, and Spectacular Spider-Man is chugging along, but its regular writer, J.M. DeMatteis, is leaving the book. And Mark DeMatteis had asked me to come in and script his last issue, which I did. So I was on board. I was already sort of in place. And what happened was the book's editor, Ralph Macchio, came to me one day and said, "Listen, Glenn, I don't have a new writer to replace Mark on Spectacular Spider-Man. And what I could really use is a multi-part story, something really marketable, that just to keep me, chugging along for the next few months. Do you have any interest?" And I said to Ralph, because an idea had just popped into my head, I said, "Ralph, let me get back to you. I just need to make a phone call." The idea that popped into my head was, the Goblins, War of the Goblins, original Hobgoblin versus original Green Goblin. So that was the idea that I came up with. But I immediately stopped myself from accepting the offer because that was Roger's idea. I mean, that's a story that Roger wanted to do. For me to come in and take that idea and do it on my own, I just felt would have been, completely inappropriate. So the phone call that I made once Ralph left my office was to Roger, and I said, "Look, Roger, I'm in a position now to do that story. I've been offered to do Spectacular Spider-Man. That's the first idea that popped into my head. I don't want to do it without you. Would you be interested in co-writing the story with me, or sort of like, overseeing the story or consulting on, whatever role you want to have, you can have. If you say no, I won't do the story." And Roger said, "Yeah, sure, sounds great." So, we got to talking, and I said, "Roger, I don't have the whole thing plotted out, but I have the spark of the idea. The spark of the idea is that the Hobgoblin came about because he found one of Norman Osborn's old journals." And when I said journals, Roger just, you could hear on the other end of the phone, Roger just sort of perking up. And I said, "What if and Roger just kind of like, you know, kind of finished the sentence for me. So it was obvious that he and I were completely in sync on this. So to sort of like wrap up this you know, explanation, the way it worked was that Roger and I would talk on the phone. It was a three-part story. Each time there was a new part to work on, Roger and I would talk on the phone and kind of kick ideas back and forth. I would write a plot, a loose plot. I would email it to Roger. Roger would then go in and make whatever revisions or suggestions or notes or whatever, you know, necessary. So it was just he and I bouncing ideas off each other and working together. Once I got back Roger's response, I would put it together into a formal, tight plot and send it to Roger. He would either, you know, make additional notes or just say, this sounds great. And then I would submit it to the editor. And once that was done, I would get the artwork from our penciler, Luke Ross, and then I would write the script solo. Once the script was written, Roger, I would send it to Roger, who would, you know, again, either okay it or make any suggestions or notes. So that's why I think it was credited Roger Stern and Glenn Greenberg plot Glenn Greenberg's script. You know, Roger always, you know, has always said since back then, he's always said he doesn't know why I gave him, you know, top credit, top billing on the story, because I, you know, as he would say, I did all of the heavy lifting. But, you know, the fact that he said okay to the story, the fact that he agreed to work with me on it, and the fact that he created the Hobgoblin, you know, I felt more than earned him the right to have top billing. Plus his name, I felt his name was a selling point. You know, having Roger Stern's name on a Spider-Man book again was a very good thing. So I felt, you know, given my stature and his stature at, you know, especially at that time, yeah, Roger's name goes first.
Okay, now, I know reading in some places that there were some things that resulted in, there was some editorial interference with parts of it where basically they wouldn't allow Norman to be in the Green Goblin costume, and I know you said, and I'm forgive me if I can't remember where, but you said he had a Green Goblin assistant that was supposed to be, I can't remember the guy's name, Urich, Phil Urich. He was supposed to be the good guy Green Goblin. It was supposed to be him, but for some reason, Bob Harris nixed it. Do you know why that was?
Well, Bob Harris had nothing to do with it. I never mentioned Bob Harris's name in all that.
Okay,
so,
it might have been the editorial. I'm sorry.
No, I don't think it's you. I think I once saw it on Wikipedia. Somebody wrote a piece about it and incorrectly, you know, placed responsibility at Bob Harris's feet. And no, he had nothing to do with it. It wasn't him at all who stepped in. The bottom line is that Roger and I worked out the story. And one of the caveats that kind of came late into the game was correct. You are correct. Is that Norman couldn't be in the full Green Goblin costume. The regular writer of Spider-Man at the time supposedly had long range plans for Norman as the Green Goblin, and for that to have impact, he couldn't be seen as the Goblin until this storyline that he had in mind. So, you know, it's sort of like the idea of not giving too much of a good thing, you know, until like the main course. So step one was we couldn't have a full out battle between the Hobgoblin and Norman in you know, the Goblin suit. So we were a little disappointed by that, but, you know, we were able to work around it. And I think it actually ended up being a pretty funny moment where the only thing that Norman can put on is the mask. And he's flying around New York at one point wearing a business suit and the Green Goblin mask. And it actually turned out to be one of my favorite little moments in the story. And I remember having these two cops watching as Norman flies away. And one of them says, is that the Green Goblin? And the other cop says, well, if it is, he's certainly dressing better these days.
I remember that.
So I ended up, you know, I guess that's what they call, you know, turning a lemon into lemonade, because I ended up, the fact that I still remember that line 15 years later says something. It gave me a great opportunity to work in a little bit of humor and a funny little bit there. But the other thing was that Roger and I still can't remember who came up with the bit. Roger says it was me, and I remembered it being Roger, but he probably has a better memory than I do, so I'll take the credit. But the idea was, and I had set this up in the Osborne Journal, which I had written a year or two earlier, that Phil Urich had become this heroic Green Goblin, and Norman did not like that. And he wrote in his journal that he was intending to, you know, make Phil Urich pay at some point. So that was sort of like floating around in the ether there. You know, it was sort of like an unfulfilled story, you know, point that I just kind of left there. And it came to me when we were doing Goblins at the Gate to pick up on that, because nobody was using Phil at the time. And nobody planned to use Phil at the time. So I had, you know, discussed it with Roger, and I took it to the Spider-Man editor and said, listen, for the big wrap-up, we've got to unmask the Green Goblin, whoever's been posing as the Green Goblin, since Norman's got this sort of like stand-in guy, this henchman, who's been operating as the Green Goblin to take any suspicion away from Norman that he ever was the Goblin. Okay. So at the climax of the story, maybe the one thing that Spider-Man can really sort of accomplish is that he unmasks the Green Goblin, and we find out that it's Phil Urich, and that somewhere behind the scenes, Norman had captured Phil Urich, brainwashed him, and made him, you know, basically his slave. And the editor had approved it, and the editor being Ralph Macchio, and Roger and I were, you know, that was what we were planning to do when we wrapped up the story. But right around the time we started working on the plot for part three, Ralph did come to me and said that the writer of Spider-Man at the time, the regular writer, did have plans for this sort of, you know, stand-in goblin. He was eventually going to reveal who that person was, and, you know, please don't do that in our story, you know, avoid that. So I was kind of crushed by that, because that to me was, you know, number one, it was going to be the big twist, and I felt it would have had a lot of emotional impact, and it also would have given Spider-Man a little bit more of a major role in the story, because he was kind of like overshadowed by Roderick Kingsley and Norman Osborn, you know, in the storyline. But, you know, the one thing that I did understand and agreed with was that when it comes to this kind of stuff, the guy who is the main writer on Spider-Man and who's basically, you know, working on the A-book is the one who gets to call the shots. And, you know, you have to respect that. So, you know, you may not like it, you may be disappointed, but you have to respect it. And so, you know, I went back to Roger and, you know, explained all this to him, and eventually we came up with the solution that we had, which was, you know, the guy is unmasked, we don't see who it is, so that the story gets to sort of, you know, continue on for another day, and you know, it's unresolved, and we just did the best we could.
You know, mentioning Phil Urich, I actually had an ideal for him, and I can't believe it wasn't done, because I just, you know, and Marvel a couple of years ago did this thing where Norman Osborn got busted and went to jail, and I had this ideal that he would somehow frame Phil Urich and retroactively for everything the Green Goblin ever did.
Well, that's kind of what we were, you know, not everything that the Goblin ever did, because Phil was too young. Phil would have been like, you know, I mean, if you go by the timeline, Phil would have been about, you know, 14 years old when the Goblin first...
I was only 14!
Was that?
Yeah.
But at least for his most recent bout of crimes, yeah, I mean, Norman could have framed Phil for that kind of stuff. And I think that's kind of what Roger and I had in mind. You know, it's unfortunate. I think it would have made for a better story, but you know, that's the breaks when you're working in a shared universe.
You know, I was picturing this thing, you know, because he'd have a good opportunity to blame Bart Hamilton. And it's like, so, Mr. Osborne, you're saying Bart Hamilton did it, and North's body gets sunk. Yes, he did it all. No, he did it! He's a loser! I'm the Green Goblin!
Right. Well.
You know, he just can't bear to let a guy like that take his credit.
Yeah.
Now, one thing you were talking about, we didn't get a chance to talk about this, you wrote Rampaging Hulk, which I think that was the... It was kind of like the Hulk version of Untold Tales, and you said you were not very happy when you were doing that?
No.
All right, can you tell me how you got the job on the book and the problems that came along?
Well, you know, what had happened was, you know, we wanted to increase our presence outside of comic book stores. And so the president of Marvel at the time decided that we would launch two new books that would be, you know, sold in more mainstream outlets, Walmart, supermarkets, I guess newsstands and all that kind of stuff. And the two books that he wanted to launch were a second Hulk book and a second Captain America book. The second Captain America book became Captain America: Sentinel of Liberty. With the Hulk book... I desperately wanted to edit it, but the editor-in-chief ended up giving it to another person to edit. And that editor came to me, and knowing of my fondness and my knowledge of the Hulk, and he said to me, he admitted, he goes, look, I don't know anything about the Hulk. Can you help me? I'm getting these proposals in. Can you give them a look and let me know what you think of them? Who do you think would be, you know, the best writer? So I read all of them, and I went back to the editor, and I said, look, I don't think any of these proposals work. I mean, one guy wanted to have it that the Hulk had killed, you know, many people over his, you know, over the course of his rampages, but Rick Jones, the Hulk's faithful companion, had basically, you know, kept all that information from Banner so that Banner wouldn't know just how much damage and destruction and death he'd caused, because he would never be able to live with himself. And I was like, what? I was like, this is insanity. You're establishing that the Hulk is a murderer. You know, he's supposed to be the protagonist of this book. So it was
that kind of thinking.
I'm sorry?
I just said that type of thing, you know, it turns the Hulk into a murderer, and it turns Rick into a different type of person.
Absolutely. You know, and I think the writer, the writer was trying to, like, really shake things up and put a whole new perspective on things, but to me it was very short-sighted, because it was like, you're establishing that your lead character is a mass murderer. Maybe unwittingly, but how is anybody supposed to root for this guy, you know? And it makes Rick, it completely changes the character of Rick. So I was very... adamant that you know, that kind of thinking was not going to work. And basically what happened was that the editor just kept coming back to me, you know, with questions and, you know, and asking for advice and all this. And, you know, it got to the point where it was like mid to late December, and the first issue was supposed to be done by February. And usually in comics, you know, you want to be working 3 months ahead. So the book was already a month behind. And I said to the editor, you know, look, you know, you're running out of time here, and you don't have any prospects. And this was not something that I was intending to do. Like I said, I wanted to edit the book. But I said, look, what if I write a proposal of what I think the series should be? You know, you're desperate here. You know, it's like, and you've got, you're not in any position to hire somebody. Let me write something up. And he was like, yeah, please do. So I think over the course of one night, and I went home that night and, you know, I guess, you know, had a 2-liter bottle of Coke next to me as I jumped onto the computer to, you know, to stay awake. And I worked most of the night on a proposal just off the top of my head. I said, this is what I think the book should be. And I turned it in. And the next thing I knew, you know, the guy came back to me and said, you got the job. And I was like, oh, well, okay. So... hammering out the details. I mean, ideally, what I wanted the book to be was a companion book to The Incredible Hulk. I would have loved to have been able to write the Hulk as Peter David was writing him at the time. I like the more intelligent Hulk. I like, you know, not to the point where he's got Banner's, you know, brain, but that he's more intelligent. He can speak in full sentences, you know. He could be snarky. He could be mean. He could be, you know, extremely funny, you know, under the right circumstances. So that's the Hulk that I really wanted to write. That's the Hulk that Peter was essentially writing at the time. But I was told, no, it had to be the Hulk Smash Hulk. I was like, all right, fine. Well, if we're going to do that, then it has to be set in the past. I was, you know, advised at one point to set it back during the earliest days of the Hulk, basically, you know, within the first six issues. And my argument was, but the Hulk Smash Hulk didn't exist back then. And I was told, don't be so bound by continuity. And I was like, yeah, but if you're not bound by continuity, then the readers are going to reject it. You have to work within, you know, within the continuity. So we reached a compromise, and basically it was set during the mid-1970s continuity. If you really want to place it, you know, in a bubble of time, I would say it the whole series takes place after Len Wein. And just as Roger Stern was, you know, after Len Wein left the book and just as Roger Stern was taking over. So, you know, Roger Stern's first issue was, this sort of standalone storyline. It has a clean beginning where Banner is, you know, miraculously cured of being the Hulk. Okay, well, my series takes place right before that issue. It's right after Len Wein leaves and right before Roger Stern takes over. Okay, great. So you've got all the characters in place. You've got Glenn Talbot. You've got General Ross. You've got Betty Ross, who's married to Glenn Talbot. And, you know, the Hulk is just as the way most people remember him, you know, Hulk smash and, you know, basically leaping around the country, the world, can go anywhere, do anything. And that kind of gave me some freedom. I just had to work within the parameters of Marvel continuity at the time. So, all right, great. So that was how the series got its start. In terms of why I was so disappointed, well, again, the first disappointment was that I had to set the stories in the past, which was not ideal for me. I didn't think that, you know, readers really wanted to see that because you're stuck basically with the Superboy syndrome. You know how everything's going to turn out, you know? So my focus was on introducing new characters whose futures weren't so mapped out. You can kill them, you can maim them. There's at least some semblance of suspense there because obviously nothing could happen to the main characters. So that was a source of frustration. The other source of frustration was I didn't feel that I was paired with the right artist. I felt that the art style was not ideal for a Hulk book. The fact that there was no creative chemistry between the artist and myself added to that. He and I were just working at cross purposes. We were not working on the same level, and we were not communicating well for whatever reason. I feel like I made a concerted effort to communicate with this artist, to work with him. He didn't reciprocate. So there was a lot of, you know, frustration in that regard. I didn't feel that, you know, he was drawing the stories that I was writing. He might have felt that I wasn't writing the stories that he wanted to draw, but we were not communicating well with each other. And it just was a source of frustration because the Hulk is my favorite comic book character aside from Batman. And to be able to launch and write a Hulk series of my very own should have been a dream come true, but it turned out not to be.
Another thing you were doing at Marvel as writing goes, you were writing Star Trek: The Untold Voyages, and again, I've spent all week trying to find those issues, and I couldn't find them. But I was reading, and again, you can correct me if I'm wrong, what guidelines did Paramount give you?
I mean, in writing it, there were no guidelines. It was basically everything that you've seen in the TV shows and the movies is canon. That has to be adhered to. It has to be sort of, you know, paid attention to. don't reference any other comic book series that were done, you know, the DC series or the original Marvel series or, you know, the Wilds, whatever, any other time that a company, you know, did Marvel, did Star Trek, don't reference those. Don't reference the novels. All that stuff is speculative. But, you know, as long as you adhere to the TV shows and the movies, you're golden. And they were very encouraging. I mean, I came up with stories, and you know, sometimes they didn't like a particular storyline, or they didn't like the details of a particular storyline, or they felt that it got too close to an episode of, say, Voyager, or we used the name of that ship in an episode of Deep Space Nine. Can you change the name of the ship? You know, if I have like a an alien ship come in, and it had the name of an alien ship that was used in Deep Space Nine. Oh, it's too close. Can you change it? That kind of thing. But for the most part, I found them to be extremely encouraging and creative, and I want to say nurturing. I wouldn't go that far to say nurturing, but encouraging. They were very positive, and whenever the criticism came, it was constructive. And this is another thing that I really need to say, is there was a certain amount of freedom to sort of, argue back. If they came down with some kind of edict or suggestion or note, you could go back to them and say, now, wait a minute. This is what I was intending to do. This is what I like. This is why I think the way I have it works. And on a couple of occasions, they backed off and let me do the story that I wanted to do. And my understanding is that just a few years earlier, with writers of the order of Peter David, that wasn't even thinkable. So things had certainly changed since then, and I had a very positive experience working with them.
When you were writing the series, was there anything you were really, when you first got the assignment, did you have any stories in your head you wanted to do immediately? Like you'd had it percolating in your head for years?
Yeah, I mean, what happened was we got the Star Trek license, and my editor, Tim Tuohy, who was a major, major Star Trek fan just like me, we were completely simpatico. And, Tim took over some of the Star Trek titles. And I just remember being in his office, and I said, "What if we did a 5-issue limited series set after the first movie that bridges the gap between the first movie and the second movie? It explains the uniform changes, and it focuses on getting the characters from the end of the motion picture to basically the beginning of the Wrath of Khan." And Tim, if I remember correctly, Tim is the one who sort of unofficially named it the Great Pajamas Saga, where basically, if you remember from Star Trek The Motion Picture, the uniforms look like gray pajamas. And I was like, exactly, the Great Pajamas Saga, and some of the ideas that I had just kind of burst forth, immediately. And, Tim was like, write it up, I'll send it right off to Paramount. And I think, again, it was one of those things where I went home that night, jumped on my computer, and it just burst forth, So, yeah, I mean, the first issue had to be, Kirk sort of like being unsure of himself after the motion picture and wondering, do I still have what it takes to be a captain on a long-range mission? I mean, yes, I succeeded against V'ger, but do I have what it takes to go out there for another 5 years and be the captain again? And so, yeah, that was the point of the first story. I wanted to do a story about McCoy and his daughter. I wanted to do a story about Spock and Savick, who, of course, was introduced in Wrath of Khan. Where did this character come from? And stories had been done about Savick's origin before. Some of them contradicted each other. So I wanted to do something that sort of took all the various threads that had been introduced by other writers with regard to Savick and distilled them down into one unified story. I wanted to do a story, showing Sulu, really sort of, being, in command of the ship during a crisis situation, to foreshadow him becoming a captain in Star Trek VI. And I wanted to do a story that answered the this major question is why, after getting the Enterprise back in the motion picture, did Kirk give it up again to the point where in Wrath of Khan he's so unhappy because he's a desk bound admiral? Well, why did you give up the ship in the first place? Again for the second time. Well, how did you let that happen to you? So I wanted to address that too. So maybe the particulars of the stories weren't worked out that early, but certainly I knew the stories that I wanted to tell, the beats, the basic premises.
Another thing, at the time when Marvel had the Star Trek license, they did a Star Trek versus X-Men crossover. They even had a novel. Do you know how that came about?
Well, I think I don't know the details because I wasn't in on the early stages. I do know that they really wanted to announce in a big way that Star Trek was back at Marvel. And what better way to do that than to pair Star Trek with Marvel's biggest guns, which at the time were the X-Men. And I think nowadays, if that was to happen nowadays, it would be Star Trek Avengers. I think that would be a no-brainer. But at the time, the X-Men were the biggest thing that Marvel had going at the time. And I just think it was a thought of what better way to launch this Marvel Star Trek initiative than to do a crossover, because you have to remember crossovers were all the rage back then. I mean, Marvel was crossing over with DC what seemed to be like on a monthly basis, and all the other companies were crossing over with each other. Batman, Spawn, Batman, crossovers galore. So it just, from a marketing standpoint, from a gimmick standpoint, it absolutely made perfect sense. I do remember after it was announced, seeing Scott Lobdell in the hallway at Marvel, and he'd already been announced as the writer, and I remember taking him by the arm and taking him aside, and I said, two things you have to do. You have to have a scene between the Beast and Dr. McCoy, where they call each other Dr. McCoy, calls out Dr. McCoy, and they both answer yes. I said, you have to have a scene like that in there. I said, and the other thing you have to have is Kirk has to hit on Jean Grey. He just has to. If I remember correctly, both of those things happened in Star Trek X-Men, but I can't remember for sure, but I think at least both of them did. And, as I was, mentioning these ideas to Scott, he was like nodding, saying like, yeah, absolutely. So, I think that's how it came about.
Yeah, I just found an interesting thing because that's the only time I can think of that Star Trek crossed over with another property.
Well, officially, I think you're right. Yeah, until recently. Now you've got Star Trek Legion of Superheroes and Star Trek The Next Generation Doctor Who.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you can tell I'm not really up to date on things.
Yeah, no, IDW has done a couple of crossovers recently, both of which I've read. And I enthusiastically recommend Star Trek: The Next Generation meets Doctor Who. I thought it was a real hoot. I thought it was a lot of fun to read.
Yeah, that seems like a really natural crossover to do.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Everybody who worked on it did a really, really good job, and I highly recommend that book.
Okay, another big project you did at Marvel, yes, you wrote it. I mean, I think it's a big project because I believe this reintroduced Dracula into the Marvel Universe again after being brought back.
Yeah.
You wrote a 3-issue Dracula miniseries.
Yes.
How did you get the job for that? And what guideline? Were you allowed to make up your own plot, or was it just like, okay, here's what we want to do, can you make it happen?
No, this was generated by me. And again, I was working with Tim Tui. Our Star Trek collaboration was so fruitful that I was happy to end up working with him on Dracula as well. No, what happened was with Dracula, I loved the Tomb of Dracula series. I read it from beginning to end at least two or three times. And I intend to do it again in the very near future. And what happened was, I mean, this dates back to 1991. It was when I wrote my first notes based on doing a Dracula story. Whether it was going to be from Marvel or another company or even a novel, I don't know. I just remember that in 1991, I was just out of college, and I was writing down ideas for a story to continue this the saga of Dracula. And I didn't join Marvel until 1992. You know, so yeah, again, I had no idea where this story was going to happen. I just knew I wanted to do Dracula. And once I was ensconced in Marvel, again, I had this big idea that I wanted to do. But as I was developing as an editor and starting to get my feet wet as a writer, the original idea that I had, I was going to be doing a series of short vignettes featuring Dracula, individual short stories, 8 pages apiece, that were going to appear in Marvel Comics Presents, if you remember that series.
Yeah.
It was a biweekly anthology series. And the editor of Marvel Comics Presents at the time was on board, you know, and so he commissioned these Dracula stories. I wrote them. I had about 4 or 5 different stories that were set to go. And for whatever reason, and I can't remember why, it never flew. Those stories never got done. Either the editor left staff or Marvel Comics Presents was canceled. But for whatever reason, those little vignette stories never got done. So I kind of put everything on the shelf for a while. And, you know, as I started getting more and more writing assignments and my name became, you know, a little bit more prominent in the comic book industry, I dusted off the Dracula proposal, the full Dracula proposal that I had written, the big story as opposed to these vignettes, and I dusted it off and I revised it and I ran it by a couple of people at Marvel, one of whom was Ralph Macchio, who had worked on the original Tomb of Dracula series. He worked on the Black and White magazine from the late 70s, early 80s, and he wrote one of the best issues of that series. So I got his feedback, and he was very helpful. And to the point where I had a finished, fully realized proposal, and I submitted it to one editor who liked it a lot, but kind of sat on it for a while. And I'm not sure why. I think, you know, he had a particular artist in mind for it and wanted to wait before the artist, you know, until the artist was available before he would, like, kind of put it through the system to see if it would fly. And I got tired of waiting, so I asked him if I could pull it back from him and you know, give it over to Tim Tui, who had, you know, who, when I mentioned the idea to him, he expressed a lot of interest. So I was like, okay, if Tim's going to jump on it, I want to go with Tim. And Tim jumped on it. I mean, Tim was fantastic. I mean, he got it right through the system. He let me pick the artist, Pat Olive, because I had come in with Pat's adaptation of Frankenstein that he had done a few years earlier with Martin Powell. And Tim was like, yeah, this guy's great. And Tim also took my suggestion of Tom Palmer as inker. Tom, of course, had worked on the original Tomb of Dracula and was instrumental in its success. So Tim was extremely, you know, open to my suggestions beyond just the writing part. It was great. It was a true collaboration between Tim and myself. It was my story. It was my, you know, ideas. It was my characters. You know, and of course I took the story and, you know, adapted it. It's not the story that I originally had in mind in 1991. In fact, it's a far cry from the story that I originally had in mind, but I made it work for the Marvel Dracula, and our goal, both Tim and myself, our goal was to restore Dracula to how he had been portrayed in The Tomb of Dracula by Marv Wolfman, Gene Colan, and Tom Palmer, because once they brought him back, Marvel, he was a far cry from what he had been. I mean, one writer I remember, I cringed. One writer had Dracula as a bat flying over Manhattan singing New York, New York. And I was like, oh, my God. I mean, it was just like, I mean, I'm not making this up either. I mean, this is absolutely true.
Yeah, I vaguely remember this. I just can't remember where I would have seen it at.
It was probably in the Blade series, because Blade had his own series for a while, and they eventually brought Dracula in. And there was one point where he was flying as a bat, and he was singing, "If I can slake it here, I can slake it anywhere." And I was like, "Oh my God!" I said, "We've got to pull him back from this." And Tim felt exactly the same way. And I think, you know, to Tim's credit, you know, once Tim knew that he was going to be editing this project, Tim went home and read the entire Tomb of Dracula series. And I think he went so far as to read the novel as well. And actually, so did I. I mean, both of us, I think, were reading, you know, the all of this stuff pretty much at the same time. And the idea was not just to restore Dracula to how he was in Tomb of Dracula, but also to have some more links to the original novel. And so Tim and I were really, really on the same wavelength and in sync on this. And it really was one of the most pleasant experiences I ever had working at Marvel.
It was, like I said, I hunted that down this week, and I really, really enjoyed it. I thought you did a great job with it. Like Dracula, I liked how Dracula and Lilith, you never gave them, like you never backed down from them hating each other, like in not just the minor hate, like they want to kill each other. Like, you know, there was never any, some people would kind of blink at that.
Well, you know, I was just building on what Marv and what Ralph Macchio had done in their previous stories. I mean, both Marv and Ralph had done what I thought were the quintessential Dracula Lilith stories. And so, you know, I mean, I don't think anything would have been gained by softening the relationship between them. I mean, you know, the other thing is, you know, having read the story, you know, Lilith was at peace when she finally went to her eternal rest. You know, there was a, you know, to make it a long story short for readers who you know, or listeners who haven't read the story, you know, there was a magical spell that had wiped all the vampires off of Earth. And Lilith went to her final rest with peace and satisfaction, knowing that Dracula was going to be dead too. And so when Dracula was resurrected before I you know, got to do my story, my rationale was that, well, if Dracula is brought back from the dead, automatically Lilith has to be brought back too, because Lilith's curse is that she is supposed to be Dracula's eternal nemesis. So she's pissed off that Dracula has spoiled it for her. She finally, after 500 years, she was finally at rest, and now Dracula's back doing his thing again, and she's been interrupted from her rest. So, yeah, I mean, she's got a real beef against him. And so I really wanted to sort of reestablish that. So, yeah, it was – I didn't see either of them backing down. And if you ever get a chance, you should hunt down the black and white magazine, Tomb of Dracula number 5, which Ralph wrote the real central story, where it really puts a real definitive – spin on Dracula and Lilith's relationship. There is no peace to be had between these two, at least not at this point. I mean, it was part of their history that at one point they had a truce and they went their separate ways for about 100 years or two. But, yeah, I mean, after the stories that I had read, these two hate each other. And they may be brethren, they may be blood relatives, but they are not ever going to get along. And it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun playing that out. My biggest regret is that I wasn't able to do more with it.
You know, we're about to be cut off. I just wanted to – one last thing I wanted to note about it. Another thing I like that you did with Dracula is you really illustrated that even before he became a vampire, this was one evil person. Like he was completely evil before he ever became a vampire.
Well, again, that was done by Marv and by Ralph before I ever got to the character. And the funny thing, I just got to give this funny anecdote before we get cut off, is, you know, with my Dracula series, I thought I had, you know, basically recaptured the look and the feel and the spirit of Tomb of Dracula, and I was so proud of myself. And then right as it was coming out, I read an interview with Marv Wolfman where he said that he was always very conscious never to have thought balloons coming from Dracula, that you were never privy to his thoughts. And I was so heartbroken reading that, because throughout my series, it's thought balloons galore with Dracula. And I had missed that one simple storytelling point that Marv had made. And I remember telling Marv about it, and he was like, well, don't beat yourself up. But I was like, I was crushed because I had missed that one simple point, not to give Dracula thought balloons. And if I was able to go in and do it again today, I would do it a completely different way.
All right. Well, Glenn, thank you for joining us. It was a lot of fun. On Friday, I'm going to have Fabian Nicieza. God, I hope I pronounced that right.
You got it right.
He'll be on Friday. Okay, he'll be on Friday. Thank you again, Glenn. Good day, everybody.
Thanks, Victor.
All right.